Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker Football Podcast. As you may have already guessed, I am not Jake Entwistle. He's having a well-earned holiday before the Premier League season starts. My name is Thomas Rooney. You might remember my voice if you listened to the Squawker Talker back during the World Cup of last summer. I've got two regulars of the Squawker Talker with me though. Mr. Will Hall, the Chief Editor. How's it going, mate?
Yeah, well, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's been a while. And also got Mr. Sam Long, the Rich Content Editor. How's it going, Sam?
Very well, thank you.
Good stuff. It's really nice to be back and I'm looking forward to discussing these few bits and pieces. We're going to go through three main topics on this podcast. We've got the Community Shield obviously coming up this weekend, which we'll dive into. We're also going to look at the newly promoted clubs, which might be another reason I'm on this podcast, because I've got a few strong opinions on that, as you know.
The Norwich expertise.
The Norwich angle. I've been wheeled out for this, and I guess I will be when we qualify for the Champions League as well. Then a bit of a European dive as usual. Arsenal potentially making a big signing in the coming days, and just that's how we'll round things up. So we are going to start with the Community Shield, though. Often sort of it's called the curtain raiser of the Premier League season. I can't really believe it's with us already. It seems to have gone very, very quickly. Liverpool versus Manchester City, 3 p.m. on Sunday. First of all, I'm going to go to you, Will. How do people see this trophy? Is it a real trophy? Obviously, a lot of people seem to... I think Mourinho called it one of his... when he won the Europa League.
Yeah. So of course he did.
Can you combine it with two other trophies and call it a treble, for example, or is it literally just a glorified friendly?
Yeah, to be technical, the debate really starts and ends with the FA's definition, because they get to decide what gets classified as what. It's a competitive Super Cup. It's not a major honour. I don't think too many people would claim it is. Liverpool's 15 charity shields, for instance, do not figure among their 42 major honours referred to on the club's website. But as you've sort of mentioned there, if they win on Sunday, we might see them continue the trend of Community Shield winners deciding it's a major honour or including it in the sort of trophy haul come the end of the season. Like City did, I think, include it in their self-bestowed formidable's nickname last season, as you mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
And in his first season, Man United's manager, Jose Mourinho, got his players to hold up three fingers to signify the three trophies they've won.
Yeah, I was trying to work out what the third one was.
Exactly. So tellingly, they both wait until the end of the season. There's no reason not to celebrate it. But it's a stat padder that's sort of used to complement real success.
And so I suppose linked to that, it's in terms of how much impact does it then have, do you think, on the upcoming season, Sam, and pre-season form in general? Because obviously Liverpool have struggled a bit in pre-season, but would a defeat this weekend affect their start of their season? Or how much can you read into pre-season form and this game in general?
Yeah, I don't think you can really get away from that it can turn into a bit of a statement if Liverpool or City win this weekend. Because if Liverpool turn up and have rings run around them and City look really good, then the early narrative is sort of written that Liverpool are playing catch up. The ground can of course be made up pretty quickly, but it would put a spring into the victor's step. And when the league was won by a single point, I think you have to take that into account. But on to pre-season form, primarily it's about building your fitness levels. That's the main purpose, and I think getting too bogged down in performances is pretty much a waste of time. Sometimes teams have poor results but start the season well, and sometimes teams look great before the serious stuff gets going and then end up getting stuck in the blocks. There's not really any rhyme or reason to it when entire 11s are being changed, youth prospects are being played, players coming back at different stages of their individual fitness programs. Liverpool obviously got quite a bit of flack for their results, especially the defeat against Napoli. Klopp, he's been quick to admit that the results haven't been where he wants them to be, but then he's also been keen to stress that he's really pleased with the training sessions that have been going on behind the scenes. And if they're making good progress there, then really that is what matters.
It's also not always the case that the two big title rivals will play in this Community Shield.
Yeah, it's quite
unusual.
Unique, I suppose.
And
yeah,
the fact
true,
that it's
yeah.
the runners-up and not the FA Cup winners, obviously because Man City won the FA Cup as well. The fact that it's Liverpool versus Man City does sort of raise the stakes. That said, it doesn't necessarily guarantee success in the form that both of these teams will be hoping for over the course of this season. I think only six of the Community Shield winners during the 21st century, so six of the 18 Community Shield winners since 2000, have actually gone on to win the league title.
Absolutely, yeah.
Season.
And looking more specifically at each team, starting with Liverpool, aiming for their 11th outright victory in the Community Shield. Only Arsenal and Man United have one more. I think it's maybe 15.
15, overall. We include the four shared, I believe, because it used to be shared rather than go to penalties. Recently, obviously, if it goes to penalties this time, we'll see the ABBA testing.
This is true. Again as well. A shared Community Shield, what better way to start the season, eh?
So we go to penalties in the current format.
Yeah, just mean in general, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, speaking about Liverpool, obviously the biggest success over the last couple of years and the big pillar point to their success in terms of the Champions League and coming close in the Premier League is their front three, Will. But after long summers, after long seasons as well, are you a bit concerned of how those three are going to perform when the season starts and in what could be such a tight title race again? Obviously, a slow start could end up costing crucial points. So are you slightly concerned with the front three and how they will shape up at the start of the season or not?
There will always be concern around those three because they are Liverpool's most precious resource. The Liverpool depend on their front three like no other big six Premier League team. So Sadio Mane, Mohamed Salah and Roberto Firmino scored 65.8% of their total goals in open plays, excluding penalties, in the Premier League last season, which is 10% higher than each of the other big six sides' top three scorers. Not technically front threes. The front three and the top three goal scorers will obviously go hand in hand a lot of the time, but an important distinction to make because obviously Manchester United's top goal scorer last season was Paul Pogba. But so there's the evidence to support this notion that Liverpool depend on their front three more than any other sort of a top Premier League team. And my personal view, as I said, after Liverpool won the Champions League on this podcast, is they could do, well, I think they do need a backup wide player, a new backup wide player to support them with enough quality. Like Origi obviously has often played in that wider role, but I think some often better through the middle. Mm-hmm. But more generally, coming back to this point of this dependence on the top three, I think it's easy to get it backwards and see it as a weakness, when in fact, Liverpool depend on them because they are incredibly dependable. So a CIES Football Observatory study included all three of them in their top 10 most valuable players in world football last month, making Liverpool the best represented team in that ranking order. And one of the factors among many that was fed into this algorithm was minutes. And the time on the field all three enjoy together, due to their durability, is what enables them to create the level of chemistry necessary to score so many goals, create so many chances. Firmino missed only 15 games through injury during his four seasons at Liverpool, according to Transfer Market. It's a games missed through injury function. They've got the same figure for Sadio Mane. Obviously, he's played one for your season, I believe. Mohamed Salah has only missed one game due to injury, and that was due to concussion. The 4-0 comeback versus Barcelona, that's according to Transfer Market. I could have sworn there must be more, but I couldn't find one. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason why is because we always associate that injury that he suffered in the Champions League final, which obviously that ruled him out for the summer, so it didn't necessarily have a knock-on effect for his appearances at Liverpool. And this is all not just, this is, obviously there's some degree of luck in all of this, but it's not all down to luck. It's a credit to Liverpool's fitness team and the physical condition of all three. That said, the robustness will be tested like never before in the upcoming season, ahead of which they've basically not had a pre-season. Because there is zero evidence in terms of pre-season game time on which to base any evaluation of their current condition. That could change because I think Liverpool play Lyon tonight in a friendly.
Yeah.
Roberto Firmino and Mohamed Salah are back with Liverpool's. They joined up with Liverpool's Evian training camp on Monday. Mane remains absent. Obviously, that's because Senegal reached AFCON final, which was, I think, mid to late July. Mm-hmm. He's scheduled to return, I think, during this week. So, I mean, it will be a bit of a concern, but like I said, they are quite robust characters. Mm-hmm. So if anyone can weather a sort of lack of pre-season, then it'd be those three.
I mean, it's always going to be a bit of a worry if your key players don't get full pre-seasons under their belt. Mm-hmm. But I think sort of looking at it the other way, so Firmino and Alisson as well, of course, won the Copa America. So you'd expect them to come back full of beans, sort of raring to go. And although Salah and Mane had disappointing AFCONs overall, you'd expect them to come back raring to get back on the horse and hit the ground running, they're not going to be coming back feeling sorry for themselves. So,
and also, they're playing for the Champions of Europe now as well. Like, there's this pressure there, but also they all want to hit the ground running, and that's kind of leads on to my next thing, really. Like, how do you feel, Sam, about Liverpool in general? Do you think they'll enjoy the Champions of Europe, sort of the burden of it in terms of the pressure, and do you think they can go again in the Premier League, having been close a couple of times now?
Yeah, I definitely think that they are capable of going again. Looking at their start, so they've got Norwich, Chelsea, Southampton, Arsenal and Burnley. It's a pretty difficult start, I'd say. The Chelsea and Arsenal games obviously stand out.
Wilson, my face then.
Sorry. but yeah, I think they're in a good place. Like we'll touch on about Liverpool's medical staff. But obviously, it's not ideal that their front three are coming back late. But the backroom team aren't stupid. If it means that their workflows need to be managed during the first few weeks of the season, then they will be. They just have to get on with it. I can't see them not being at least runners-up this season.
I suppose, and if Liverpool are going to be challenging for everything for the next few years, this is something they have to get used to, like long summers, competitive till the end of seasons. It's what top European clubs have to go through. It's not necessarily a huge problem. I guess it's the uniqueness of how much they rely on those guys, plus because they're so strong and have performed so well.
AFCON obviously moving to the summer has created a sort of unique problem. I think.
But then you take that rather than losing Mane in January, wouldn't you?
Exactly. Yeah, we spoke about that before on previous podcast. If Mane and Salah, and if Keita grows in importance, potentially him as well.
And just quickly on Liverpool as well. I know there's a couple of youngsters you wanted to mention. Will, Rian Brewster and Harvey Elliott. Are they two players that you feel?
Well, Harvey Elliott probably will go out on loan. Klopp suggested. Rian Brewster was supposed to have his breakthrough season was really supposed to be last season. There were reports ahead of that he was going to be fast tracked into the first team, and injury prevented this, or injury setbacks. He scored 4 goals in Liverpool's first 3 preseason games, I think, making him their top goal scorer throughout the whole of the period, because they've obviously not performed very well, so no one's been able to overtake him. Assuming that doesn't change when they play Lyon tonight, but his impact gradually waned and he was less involved in the 2-2 draw with Sporting and the game against Napoli. I think he only started the first 2 and then sort of taken out of the lineup. But I mean, you can read too much into that, because obviously they basically played like one team in one half and one team in another. To come back to the sort of whether Liverpool can lift themselves for another title challenge after going within 2 points last season. I don't think you can read too much into this, but I found it interesting enough to share that Liverpool have finished Premier League runners-up 3 times before. And in each of the 6 subsequent seasons, they've finished 6th in 2014-15. 7th in 2009-10, and then 5th in 2002. So bad omens there. However, to flip it into something else that you should probably not read too much into, the only previous time Liverpool played Norwich at home on the opening day of a season, they won the league and City came second, according to Opta.
So which one are you going to hope for?
Exactly. You've got omens.
Omens all over the shop.
Yeah.
I suppose it is about whether they can. So previously, before, maybe they thought that was their chance in the previous season and then just subsided. But it feels like there's more to this team
the
now.
The big difference is having won the Champions League, because it kind of transforms the complexion.
Interestingly, though, Klopp said, didn't he, that Liverpool aren't going to carry the Champions League with them this season. He wants it to be a new chapter. He wants to draw on the line of that.
I feel like that's inevitable, but we'll see.
Yeah, it's a good thing to say.
Yeah, exactly.
It's something only a winner can say.
And obviously Manchester City is who Liverpool are playing in the Community Shield. Champions as well, obviously the strongest team last season. We'll expect they're the favourites again this time around. Vying to win the Community Shield for a 6th time. One thing I want to speak about with Manchester City, because obviously they're going to be more of the same again, because obviously they've been incredibly strong. But one thing I wanted to mention, obviously there's no Vincent Kompany now, who's gone to Anderlecht, sort of a player manager role, which leaves a captaincy free. Now, I think David Silva, Kevin De Bruyne are probably the favourites for the position in terms of their seniority and the fact that they've been there a long time. But there were some comments about, or Raheem Sterling almost put his name into the hat, sort of inadvertently just said that he's a leader, and that he would be open to the idea of being one of those leaders, and there's several people that could do it. So Raheem Sterling's a massively important player for Manchester City, Sam, and is he a captain of the future, if not now, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, his comments were quite strange because he sort of threw his hat into the ring, but then quickly
took it back out.
Took it back out, yeah. out the
sort
ring.
Sort of dipped it in the ring. That sounds bad.
Which is like great, great leadership display there.
But is he a future captain, though? If not now.
Yeah, I would probably say he would be a future captain. I would be pretty surprised if Guardiola gave it to him now just because of the media sort of attention that would bring.
Yeah, true.
Having sort of come out the side of quite a bitter battle with the media, the coverage that he was getting. It's going to be interesting to see who he picks. I'd probably tend towards David Silva rather than De Bruyne.
Are you surprised he hasn't named it already? Or when's he presumably be the captain for this weekend? Will be
you kind
the captain,
of.
You think?
I mean, there seems to the fashion these days seems to have a leadership group, but it kind of takes the strain off having one individual. Yeah. There'll be sort of the captaincy comes with like all sorts of like administrative responsibilities sort of behind the scenes, and these can get shared between multiple players. I don't. Yeah,
that's the biggest issue. To
yeah,
be
the
fair,
extent the extent to which he chops and changes with his team. There's very few guaranteed starters.
Absolutely.
So having a fixed, firm captain is tricky. Really.
Absolutely. And talking of sort of future of Manchester City, Mr. Foden, obviously a very highly rated youngster. Pep hasn't sort of quashed that sort of fire in terms of the fact that he's called him the most talented player he's ever seen.
It almost means nothing with Guardiola, though.
I know. So
comments, because he says this so...
Has he said that to many players before?
Yeah. I have a general impression of him making these kind of comments.
Yeah.
But then he always comes down really strongly when anyone suggests or goes near suggesting Messi isn't the greatest player all the time.
It's like there's...
He likes to have it both ways in that sense.
That's true, yeah. And but just in terms of Foden, though, regardless of whether Pep's just sort of saying these things because he thinks that's the way that he'll get the best reaction out of the player, perhaps, but he's obviously a very, very good young player who was strong. One of the shining lights for England under-21s, I thought, in the summer, which went pretty wrong. But generally, how big a future has he got? And is this the season where we see even more of him? Sam, what do you think?
I really hope it is a season that he plays more. Well, in those comments from Guardiola, he said, didn't he, that his biggest problem was that sometimes his manager doesn't put him in the starting 11.
Yeah, how could he solve that, I wonder?
To sort of obviously shoulder a bit of the responsibility. But yeah, I'd love to see Foden play a bit more, but I'm still not convinced that he is. I think those comments from Guardiola are more just a reminder of how much he does rate him, but he's not quite ready to play.
Yeah, I think that's probably the fact he says he can't get in the starting 11. He kind of wants to put him in the starting 11, but obviously with the players they've got, he probably can't. On that note, Kevin De Bruyne, Will, just a few words on him, because obviously last season I think it was 32 appearances for Manchester City across all competitions. Didn't have quite the impact of previous seasons. They almost won the title despite the fact of he was being out. They did succeed in lots of big games without him. Do you think he might return to the top of the tree this season
you've got to expect him to be in contention for player of the season. He's started very few games, of course, due to injury, but if you look at his sort of like per 90 stats for chances created, I think he comes out on top for chances created per 90 minutes of all players to have started 10 games. I might be wrong, but I checked that fairly recently and I seem to remember him being at the top of that.
Yep.
And if you just remember like these incredible performances, even in the defeat to Spurs in the Champions League, it was just unreal. Assist for, I think, was it the Sterling goal, maybe? I'm sort of plucking all these things from memory.
I trust you 100%.
Not from notes. So yeah, feel free to correct me, listeners. And yeah, he's also spoken about how this summer he's been able to have a detox from football due to the lack of tournament competition with Belgium, and it seems to have
put him in
a good mental state, according to, in his own words.
And it's quite scary for the rest of Liverpool, maybe particularly that they were that strong without him all the time and at his absolute best. So him in the mix at his absolute best, and that's another daunting prospect for them. Yeah. And just finally on Manchester City, Sam, just wanted to touch on Leroy Sané possibly. Possibly leaving, possibly not. How do you feel that situation is going to go? Bayern are obviously interested. But
yeah, I mean, I think it shows just how much talent City have got at their disposal that we're talking about them losing a player like Sané, but it really not making too much of a difference for them. The crux of it seems to be that he wants more game time. But last season, he made 31 appearances, 10 as a sub, and to his credit, scored 10 goals. Okay, that's not a nailed-on starter, but it's not exactly a fringe player either.
No, so you think he's the third highest league goal scorer last season, which is quite surprising, I found.
So the carrot of becoming one of Bayern's main men is a difficult one to ignore for him. We can't get away from that. With Robin and Ribery,
so it's a good time to join Bayern as a winger, isn't it?
It's a chance that's not going to come around too often. But what I have been surprised by is Bayern's approach. They've talked about Sané all summer. Given that Guardiola is their former manager, I'd expect them to be shown a bit more respect. Kovac, of course, even came out and said that he was confident that they'd sign him before another member of the club's hierarchy questioned why Kovac had said it.
Yeah, I think he apologised after the friendly to Guardiola and then kind of doubled down on the fact that he was confident of signing Sané.
So it's so hollow.
It wasn't a masterclass of apology.
Yeah, I really think it's embarrassing from Bayern the way they've gone about it, and it will be even more embarrassing if they don't end up getting it over the line, because we're only a week out now. They've been making public comments about him all the way back in sort of tail end of June.
It's an ends justify the means approach, though, really. I don't think they're particularly concerned with how it affects their public perception, because they're kind of, they must know that they're the bad guys in terms of, certainly in terms of like German football being the all-conquering, just domestically dominant team that plucks the best talents of all
from
the Bundesliga. They must know that they're not seen as like the sort of the good guys. Mm. So as I said, ends justify the means. I think they obviously feel it's a strategy that will increase the chances of signing Sané, because it will.
It puts a lot of pressure on it. Yeah,
exactly. But
they're putting pressure on him to almost say he wants to leave, aren't they? I guess.
And they're putting pressure on themselves, of course, because it will be embarrassing, doubly embarrassing if they don't get it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just a risk they're willing to take. What does it really matter? Everyone will forget about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like 2 months after the end of the transfer window.
Very true. Okay, so that's Liverpool versus Manchester City in the Community Shield this Sunday. Next up, we're going to look at the newly promoted clubs in the Premier League. So the newly promoted clubs in the Premier League: Norwich, Sheffield United, Aston Villa. We're going to go through these three teams, talk about their chances of survival, how will they approach the Premier League, what they've done in the transfer market, and just generally how we think they're prepared for the top flight. Now, I'm going to start by talking about Norwich, as you may expect if you know me, being a Norwich fan and being very excited that we are back in the Premier League. The biggest question I always get asked about Norwich being back in the Premier League, are you worried they haven't spent money? And are you worried that Farke won't stick to his philosophy? He will just almost cave into the Premier League. So we've got to survive. We need workhorses.
It's a big temptation, isn't it, to sort of revert to type and say, right, we just need to get Temer behind the ball.
So my reaction to that is that he's already proven that he won't do that, because in the Championship, when he first came, obviously his first season was average, extremely average. He was getting told to, some Norwich fans wanted him out. That's particularly at the start of last season. He has a philosophy of possession. He doesn't necessarily want his teams to go long, direct, which sometimes in the Championship you do, and you have a pressure to do. When the results weren't going well, he could have easily sort of thought, right, let's scrap this for 6 months. Let's make sure we do okay. But he didn't. He kept on his philosophy. We finished the season poorly. We basically relied on James Maddison to stay up. I think we finished 14, something like that, but we were very close to the bottom three. And it was the summer where he could have decided, I need to go a different route. But he didn't. He signed players that he would have signed anyway. He signed players that came in and fitted his philosophy. They got to fit the mindset. Like our sporting director, Stuart Webber, has said, we could have the best player in the world, but if he doesn't fit into our philosophy and our way we're going to play football, he's not going to be here. And that's the case, he said, across their media department, across their the catering, everything.
How does that philosophy?
No, just in terms of the club philosophy, is you generally, everyone is, because obviously we know about Norwich, it's the only club in the area.
Yeah.
That puts some people off in terms of coming there, but literally everyone there.
Slight dig at Ipswich though.
Well, yeah, it's different. they're two leagues apart now, mate. I can't. It's just that everyone is fighting for the same cause. And when it comes to players, we don't do well if we spend big money. Like, our record signing is Stephen Naismith, 9.1 million, 6 goals in 44 games. Mm. Ricky Van Wolfswinkel, 8 million, 1 goal in 25 games.
Yeah, he was bad, wasn't he?
He was
very bad.
Ironically, I think he'd actually do all right under Farker in the current team, but that's kind of irrelevant. So we have players that they're either... Norwich is the highest level they've played at, or the biggest club they've played at. They will then succeed with us, or certainly, or they are have been injury prone and got something to prove. So we've taken a few players from the German leagues, like Mo Leitner, for example, came from Dortmund, kind of lost his way a little bit. He was in the Champions League final when they played at Wembley, I think, a few years ago, but then lost his way, but he's come to us and improved himself again. Emi Buendia, the same, was in Spain. Nobody else was looking at him because of his attitude, which is still sometimes questionable, but Farker took a risk on him because he's got something to prove in this level. We've got some young players, obviously, as well, that are, you know, this is the highest level they've played at because they've come from our academy, or we've plucked them from the lower league. So I'd be more concerned if we were going down the big spending route, 100%, because it would just not fit into our wage structure, wouldn't fit into our policy. And as negative as it sounds, like, if we go down, we'll be absolutely fine.
Yeah.
Financially, we've built a training ground. We've got maybe 4 to 5 players on long-term contracts that in the current market are probably £20 million players.
How different does it feel to like to previous promotions?
The most recent one was when we kind of bounced straight back up.
Yeah.
So that felt, we'd had a group of players that had been there for too long in a way. So we had Jerome, we had House and Houlihan, obviously different because he was very good. But we very much, those players had experienced the relegation with us before. So then we went up under Alex Neil, who'd never managed in the Premier League.
Mm.
And we'd had too many players that had bad experiences with Norwich in the Premier League.
This time, is kind of like fresh.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't actually got the number, but a lot of people were making their Premier League debut, probably even their top flight debut, a lot of our players, in terms of any league they've played at. So this is 100% fresh. We've made like 6 signings this summer for the under-23 squad. Just players that almost like the... Say if we do lose the Aarons and Matt... We lose Max Aarons or Jamal Lewis, we've got these other guys that could slot back in. Because a year ago, if you just said to me Max Aarons is going to be as good as he is,
yeah,
I would have said, well, I'm sure he's a good young player, but he made his debut in September last year. It just shows you that they will give faith to the right people. And I think obviously a lot of people are going to, the biggest question as well is about Timu Pukki and whether he will succeed. Because obviously that's probably the big question mark, who's going to score your goals. But a few years ago, would you have said Grant Holt will score 15 Premier League goals? Probably not.
No.
But he did. because he found his club.
But we're able to say that now.
Exactly, because he did. And I checked it 4 to 5 times. But then Pukki has now found his club. I think it's a similar thing where he's been a bit of around. He scored 29 goals last season, which is his second, in terms of who he scored goals for in his career, he scored his second most in Norwich. And he's played for like 9 clubs. And that was one season. Yeah. So that shows that I think he's found his club. He's got creative players around him who will... And also he's got time on his side as well, which I think is massive. If he doesn't score for the first 5 games, we won't be saying get him out. Like, because if he went to a new club, I think I spoke this to you about you, Sam. I think he was linked with Benfica. If he goes to Benfica or something like that, if he doesn't score in 5 games, he's on the bench. With Norwich, he's going to play. And he will get time by the fans, and I think that will be huge. So it depends sort of him succeeding at the top level. What does that mean? I think... If we stay up and he scores 10 goals, he's succeeded at the top level. Will he become score 20, 25 goals, probably pushing that a little bit? Because I think our goals will be spread around a bit more. But I think he could maybe replicate the great Grant Holt and get 15 goals. Ooh, who knows?
Nice.
Because he's a very good player, very good finisher in a team that knows what their philosophy is and knows how we're going to play and will create chances. We might be dodgy at the back, and I think you'll see that almost straight away that we will concede goals, but
Liverpool first half.
Exactly. So I feel like we will.
Yeah, but we were talking a couple of days ago, and you felt that Norwich are playing Liverpool
at the best time possible.
Best time possible.
I think so. Just in terms of
which I kind of agree with.
You haven't even I doubt they've watched Norwich too much, and even if 5 games in, they might have seen a few of the things we do.
Yeah,
so.
Klopp does love a bit of German football, so yeah.
There's
sure
that link there with Daniel
Farker
as well, isn't there? And
of course,
they will know each other well. I think Jürgen Klopp managed a few of our players, like Leitner and Vrančić, I think, back in the day. Oh, okay. So there is a few links there. And I just think if you might catch Liverpool cold. Also, it's a free hit. If we lose 5-0, no one's going to think, oh, no, that's Norwich done. So I think we'll impress a few people, especially early on. I think we will stay up, but, you know, it depends on a number of things, like a couple of injuries or momentum goes the wrong way then. But Farke will stick to his philosophy. We'll play great football. You'll see some young players that will come to the fore. I mean, Aarons and people like that have been mentioned in the sort of national press before, but Emi Buendia, Jamal Lewis, Ben Godfrey, these players will be mentioned in that bracket as well. They're all tied down to long-term deals. And, you know, in this transfer market, that's a lot of talent there if we do have to end up selling at some point, which we obviously will if they succeed. So I'm reasonably quietly confident of staying up, making a good impression on the Premier League and hopefully sort of being there for many years to come rather than being up and down as much as we have been. So that's kind of how I'm feeling about Norwich.
Very positive there.
Well, if you can't be positive before a ball's kicked, then you're struggling. But if I'd have had the same conversation when we came up last time, I would have not been as positive because it's the same group of players that took us down, whereas this is completely fresh. Mm. And I think we're better than three teams in that league. I think it'd just be nice to sort of show people the way we've been playing. I think, you know, got a bit of attention last season, but just to show people how good we have been and the football that we've been playing is really strong. I think we'll win a few new fans maybe next season. So that's kind of how I'm feeling about Norwich. Reasonably positive, and hopefully that continues beyond August. But who knows football. So then I suppose it's obviously Sheffield United and Aston Villa will be rivals to us in terms of staying up. So Sheffield United have almost not done a similar approach to Norwich, but they have kind of they've stuck to the approach that got them up, if that makes sense. Mm. They're going for hard-working players. They've obviously got a manager who is very experienced in English football and wants a certain type of player. So how do you think they'll attack the Premier League, Sam? I think you've got a few views on their signings and things like this. The 20 million on McBurnie, so they're not holding back. But
yeah, so we touched on Sheffield United on a previous pod and I mentioned that they had a fully British squad except for a handful of Irishmen. And the question then was whether they would use their chance back in the big time to look further afield or continue to shop at home. And it's definitely been the latter. Wilder's made several really shrewd pickups from the Championship where you can obviously find a bit more value if not proven quality at the highest level. So Luke Freeman, from QPR, Callum Robinson from Preston, who was their top scorer last season, and Ben Osborne from Nottingham Forest gives them some really solid options in midfield and up top as well. Mm-hmm. With Robinson. And Lee Smuse from Bournemouth has obviously come in. And like you said, Ollie McBurnie, 22 goals last season in the Championship. Mm. The same as Billy Sharp and Southampton's new signing, Adams. And the 20 million fee that it looks like it's going to be for McBurnie will mean that Sheffield United have broken their transfer record for the fourth time this summer. Mm. So they can't be accused of a lack of ambition, even though they are looking closer to home. Mm-hmm. And with Sharp and McBurnie, they'll have a decent front line. Obviously, as well, Dean Henderson coming back in on loan is a big one. Every team who gets promoted from the Championship, the difficulty usually is to retain the players who've got you there, and it's inevitable that some of them are loans. While Phil Jagielka coming back in will add crucial experience at the back, even though his legs. On the way to
it's an experienced player to have there, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. And the wild card in their pack is of course Ravel Morrison. Mm. His career looked dead in the water really after a few indifferent, shall we say, spells at clubs in Italy, Mexico, and Sweden most recently. But he's got that X factor on his day. Mm. And if Wilder can unlock his potential, then they've got a real player on their hands. Of course, the problem is. He's rarely had his day.
Mm. There's a spell of a few games for West Ham where he just looked like he might be making it.
That's exactly what I was going to say. If you look back to that solo goal that he scored against Spurs, then you'd have to say he's worth having a punt on.
Yeah, because I kind of think Wilder might have looked at the squad and thought, we've got these guys will run through brick walls for me. But have I got that spark? Have I got that?
Yeah.
That X factor, as you said, and I feel like he's someone
different.
That, just a bit rogue. It might, cause they're not going to be paying him a lot of money. He might be pay-as-you-play. I'm not 100% sure, but if he doesn't work, they will just release him and it won't be a problem. They've had to take a bit of a risk there to not be just known as workmanlike Sheffield United, that teams will eventually break down. So I can see why they've done that, and I wouldn't be surprised if they try and sneak one or two more in along those lines, really, in terms of just a bit of
definitely
a pace but, and attacking.
Although obviously sort of hyping up McBurnie and Sharp a bit, my main concern would be that they would come up short in attack. But then their home games at Bramall Lane is going to be rocking every week this season. So they're going to be right in the fight, I would say.
Well, has it been 10 years since they were there or something? I think it's something like that. It's been a long time coming for their fans. They'll be really pleased to be there. So that's Norwich and Sheffield United. Obviously, Aston Villa haven't had quite as long a break from the Premier League. They're associated, obviously, big Premier League history, Will. In terms of the summer they've had, the big question has been, and a lot of people have said this, are they doing a Fulham in inverted commas even? It's the fact that they've spent quite a lot of money having just come up.
Yeah.
They've kind of naturally had to break up a squad because they had quite a lot of loans, but they have, it's soon to be 12 signings for them. So it's a bit of a revamp in terms of their team. And how do you feel about that and how that will affect them?
Well, on the surface, it does appear to be sort of continuing the weird trend of the Championship playoff winners coming up and being among the top spenders in the Premier League. But where Fulham kind of did a complete renovation, and the caveat here is that when they were making all these signings, I kind of went along with the sort of popular view that the signings they were making were pretty cool, like quite niche.
Well, I'm pretty sure if you listen to a Squawker Talker from this time last year,
you'll be able to find something.
We were bigging Fulham up.
We were probably tiffing them to go on.
I think Mo and Jake
Europa League still. Yeah, they signed some players that were right up Mo and Jake's street.
Yeah, exactly.
and obviously, Villa have signed some quite cool, relatively unknown, what you might call hipster sort of like signings from abroad. But it's difficult to really blame them for buying so many because it's come from a necessity. Like their centre-back pairing in the playoff final against Derby, Axel Tuanzebe and Tyrone Mings, both there on loan. Obviously, they've signed the latter permanently now. Amwell Ghazi, who was directly involved in both goals, was there on loan. They've signed him permanently now as well. But they've also sort of released several players who allowed their contract to expire. So they really didn't have a starting 11.
Didn't have a choice, really.
They had to sort of, you know, go on this huge recruitment drive. And the one that I find really interesting, obviously they've signed about 12 players already, or soon to be 12 players, because I think there's a couple coming in. And then this morning, the reports are saying that Tom Heaton is soon to agree a deal with them, which would see him join from Burnley for about $8 million. It's perhaps a bit harsh on Jed Steer, who was arguably their hero in the playoffs.
Yeah.
But I mean, that for me is a signing I look at being one that potentially keeps the team up. He's like a sort of, he has almost a De Gea level impact for a team further down the league in terms of like keeping out the goals that convert into points. I think over the last three seasons, the only goalkeepers with higher save percentages in the Premier League are Hugo Lloris and David De Gea. That's only considering keepers who've started a minimum of 40 games. But so he's in the top three there for save percentage, which is like the number of saves a goalkeeper makes divided by the number of goals per goal they concede. And up front, the Wesley looks like someone who's not going to offer you 20 goals, but is a good sort of link man that can hold the ball up quite nicely, and the wingers that they've got, so they've obviously got Jota and Trezeguet there to feed off them. Grealish as well. Hourihane was involved in like 20 goals for them last season.
Yeah, he'd be good from set pieces and stuff as well. He's really strong.
Seeing suggestions that he might not really be a guaranteed starter now. Obviously, they've got Douglas Luiz potentially come in to complete that midfield trio with Grealish and McGinn. But it looks like quite a cool team. I just think they're such an unknown quantity because of all these signings.
To get them to gel is
the big challenge. A very good manager in Dean Smith, and Grealish is there as one of perhaps the most naturally talented player among the three squads coming up.
Yeah, I'd say so. He's Mr. Aston Villa in a way. He will be the central point, and if there is lots of transition around him, his impact in the last third of last season when he came back from injury, huge.
I think, it was pretty, it coincided with the 10 game win streak.
Yes, it did, which kind of, even at that point, they weren't sure 100% if they were going to get into the playoffs or, because they were quite far adrift at one point. So Grealish's impact was huge. And I think he'll, because he could have easily moved, safely moved to Spurs this summer. I feel like I'd have been a bit hesitant about his impact he'd have on the season, but I think because he's still at Aston Villa and he's at the top level, I think he will flourish and be incredibly strong.
He's showing a real consistency over two seasons now as well. I think it's worth noticing.
Yeah, he's a very strong player and he'll be crucial for Aston Villa if they are going to sort of stay up and maybe progress beyond that.
Yeah, well, with the spending of Villa, I think they were always going to spend. Having been in the Premier League for so long, getting back there, their attitude was always going to be, we need to make a statement.
Yeah.
Whereas perhaps, no disrespect, a club like Norwich or Sheffield United would maybe see things a bit differently and say, if we did go back down within one or two seasons, then so be it.
Yeah, Villa don't want to be doing that.
Villa don't want to be doing that. No.
That's why I think almost, you say about Sheffield United and Norwich, finish 17th now, probably take it. I'm not sure Villa would at this point. But just to round up the newly promoted club, so I'm just going to ask you a couple of questions. I'll do mine first, just to get that out of the way. So which team is the best chance of survival and who's definitely going straight back down? So have you made guess then? I think Aston Villa have got the best chance of survival. I think they will stay up and maybe push on a little bit into the sort of mid-tableness of the Premier League. Who's definitely going straight back down? Sheffield United, obviously. I generally do think they are probably... I don't say they're definitely going straight back down. That seems a little harsh, but I think...
Why did you pose the question in that way?
Because it was written down in front of me. I don't think anyone... I think all three could stay up. Like, some people say, I think all three could go down. I think all three could stay up. Yeah. I don't think Aston Villa will go down. We'll be in the mix. And then I think Sheffield United probably, if I had to say which team is definitely going to go back down, it would be Sheffield United, just because of... I think the lack of sort of the X-Factor players. And I think if their momentum does switch and it is bad, I'm not sure. I think Wilder might try and change the guard a little bit and that might unsettle some stuff and they might go again in January, make a big loan signing that doesn't quite work. And I can see them going straight back down. But generally, I think all three teams could stay up. I think it might surprise some people. Sam?
Yeah, I think Sheffield United are going to go down as well. I think they would just come up short. Norwich and Villa, I can't see either of them pushing towards the top half. I think they'll spend the season in the relegation battle, but then pull away towards the end.
Well, Sheffield United are would be the one I go to for relegation, the prime relegation candidate. So that said, I mean, the best goal difference in the Championship last season, 37, which speaks to a strong balance. In the
defensively, the best team
and
they were.
Balance
season,
and stability is a key thing in achieving the consistency to stay in the league.
I think it might be goals for them.
Villa is just all bets are off, really. Like they've got the quality, but it's just a case of, as Sam said, whether that quality gels. And Norwich, you can just see Farke sticking to his guns.
Yeah.
While everything burns around
him. He won't be bothered by the noise from the national media or anything.
Because you can question whether Villa are doing a Fulham, but what really sort of hamstrung Fulham last season was this. They bought a new team. Well, maybe that's not fair, but they chopped and changed their back line so much and then tried to play out from the back and consistently got caught out. And then the goalkeepers they brought in couldn't decide which goalkeeper to play. Because they were regularly making mistakes, if memory serves, and it just all sort of led to calamity, and the confidence was shot to bits. And one thing you really need is confidence, and if not that confidence goes for Norwich, they get caught out in the same way.
Yeah,
then that's a. It's a downward slope.
Yeah, I think it's always how you react. We are going to lose games, and it's how you react to that. And if you don't, because obviously in the Championship we're on a run, we barely lost anything in the run-in as well. So it's how this group of players react to a bad run is going to be crucial for all three of these teams. It's obviously some fixtures you'd pick out, but then it's also maybe about a couple of shocks as well. So I think all three could surprise people, and will certainly be interesting to see how they fare for sure. So that's the newly promoted clubs, and next up we're going to be looking at a bit of a European dive. Our Arsenal about to make a big signing. We'll see. and the final section of the Squawker Football Podcast. Now, Arsenal transfer dealings this summer, Sam, have been mentioned quite a lot. How much budget they've got, whether they're going to bring in Zaha. There's been a new name on the horizon, Nicolas Pepe. First of all, how have they managed to pull it off, if they do pull it off? And where does he fit in, and do you think he'll succeed at Arsenal?
Well, credit where credit is due. I didn't think Arsenal would even be in the race to get him at the start of the summer. Having guaranteed himself Champions League football with Lille, logic said that he wouldn't even be entertaining clubs who could only offer him Europa League football, and he ended up being linked with absolutely everyone. But Arsenal look like they've won the race. Somehow they've managed to negotiate the fee over a few seasons to make their £45 million budget stretch a little bit further. Of course, Pepe had a great season in France. Only Mbappe scored more than his 22 Ligue 1 goals. But perhaps interest from elsewhere cooled, given that the French league is not regarded as particularly strong. But in terms of where he's going to fit in at Arsenal, suddenly it feels like they've got a lot of options. And I'd probably say a 4-3-3 with Pepe, Aubameyang and Lacazette, with Lacazette central, is a really tasty looking front line. Ridiculously attacking, but then perhaps not the best bet if Urza was going to be your most advanced midfielder in behind him. Or another option for Emery would be for a slightly different 4-2-3-1 with Dani Ceballos in the centre of the three with Pepe and Aubameyang, then Xhaka and Torreira in behind them in midfield. Also, Emery's used a back three a lot before, so another potential option would be 3-4-1-2 with wing backs, probably Kolasinac and Maitland-Niles, perhaps. But then that would mean dropping one of the strikers and moving Pepe into a more central role.
Bayer into his hand as well.
Bayer in, of course, yeah. But yeah, so if you move Pepe into a more central role, then it would be potentially Aubameyang, and him up top would be sort of the ultimate speed demon.
It's a conundrum, really, isn't it? Like this,
it's nice to
spend hours
like this,
trying
to
sort of figure out how he's going to fit all these attack-minded players into one team.
Meanwhile, Mustafi's still at centre-back.
He's basically just sort of he's leaned into the Arsenal reputation as of a team that is just there to score goals, hopefully more than they concede.
Yeah, I think, and that would be instead of Zaha, presumably. So do you think that's a better shout for them in terms of if you could go for one or the other? I'm not sure.
I think Zaha, even if it doesn't bring you success, it'll bring you entertainment.
Yeah. It's probably just a financial thing that obviously Palace want lots of money up front, don't they?
And I mean, it's pretty incredible, really, that Lille have agreed, because it's not often that you're going to sell someone for this big a fee if you're a club who's sort of outside of the elite. So for them to sort of take a payment that is staggered.
I've sorted suggestions from people who know more about football finance than me, that often what happens is a third party will sort of buy the debt and pay the club who sells the player a lump sum and then assume the debt that they then receive in increments over a season and season. So they might be getting a bulk payment, slightly less than the full fee. And then, as I said, a sort of third party will assume that debt. Another reason, apparently, that they signed Pepe ahead of Zaha was that Zaha's own demands in terms of salary put Arsenal off alongside Palace's demand.
Yeah, I think they just made a decision at this point and not broken their structure, not going to push, and they're going to get a very good player by the looks of it. So,
and also I think the way they went about trying to sign Zaha was a bit of a spectacular failure. Lodging their bid, which left Palace furious, was probably not...
I think, it must be 10 times harder dealing with another club in the same country, because the tensions, it's a rival, maybe not in the sense of you expect Palace to be competing directly with Arsenal for a certain position in the league, but they are a rival, and a London rival at that. So it must just lead to a certain amount of animosity, especially when you're kind of low-balling.
Absolutely, and it'll be interesting to see what Zaha does. I presume, is anyone else going to pick him up, do you think? Or probably not. Would still be
Everton, of course, issued the statement saying they consider the matter closed now after their bid was rejected. So, yeah, I think he's going to stay.
He's going to be very grumpy staying at Palace.
No, they'll take him back with open arms.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I'll say the club will.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, of course they will. He's the best player.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose they'd be delighted that they've managed to keep him somehow.
Quickly, going back to Lille, I think you do have to feel for them a bit, having done so well to get into the Champions League. Now they're selling.
Well, I don't think so, because we said previously, their owner has been so public about the interest in Nicolas Pepe, so much so to suggest they're quite happy with having a player who has a breakthrough season and then immediately cash in on him for as much money as possible that they'll reinvest. I mean, I think they've done a really good job of sort of really driving up his price over the course of the summer. He's a player who's been linked to everyone.
He has, yeah.
And as much as his agent and the interest that he's sort of garnered on merit has to do with that, the club have also been complicit in sort of stirring up this hype around a player. So, feel sorry for them. Feel sorry for their fans, maybe.
I was going to say. Yeah. Like, they've been waiting a long time to get into the Champions League, and now they're selling him. And then also Rafael Leao looks like he's on his way to Milan. So they've lost Pepe, and they've lost their next down the line player who was going to come in and potentially be their sort of star striker.
Absolutely. And another deal which has been talked about a lot, has been talked about a lot, is Lukaku. So I don't know if we've got any more views on that in terms of, there's been a Dybala swap deal mentioned with Juventus. How do you see that panning out, or is that just agents talking out? Or something, Lukaku would be great for Juventus, but you know, how do you see that panning out, and will it pan out?
I think if Man United managed to get shot of Lukaku, then it will be good business for them. I don't think he really suits what Solskjaer's trying to do. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it looked for a long time like he was going to go to Inter. And yeah, I'd agree that Serie A is definitely more suited to his game.
Yeah, I think he'd do well.
As for Dybala, it's a bit of a fall from grace from him, really. He was the absolute golden boy a couple seasons ago, and now he's being used as a bit of a make weight in the deal.
Yes, the reporting on this... So the BBC are reporting it, so you can be confident that they are in talks to sign him. Mm-hmm. I think the only condition really is the fact that Inter quite like Lukaku as well. So whether Lukaku wants to join Juve or Inter, you would think he'd be quite happy to join Juve, but might think his game time he's going to be a less important player.
He's going to play
Cristiano Ronaldo there as well. And the other hold up is like whether Dybala, who's still kind of said to be considering his future, wants to leave Juventus. I think he's seen as being a bit of a casualty of Ronaldo's arrival.
Definitely, yeah.
Albeit a player who Sarri has suggested could play alongside Ronaldo. So there's sort of, you know, a bit of tactical tweaking you could do there.
Absolutely. It'd be interesting to see that, but we can almost certainly say that Lukaku's not going to be a Man United player, isn't he? Unless
out of the pre-season squad all summer, then it seems like he's pretty much.
But they
need a replacement, though.
Yeah, they are very much playing with fire, because if it's not a sort of swap deal involving Dybala, then they've left themselves with not much time to be getting a replacement. Unless, of course, they're going to be using the money to trigger the Maguire deal.
And you could maybe say that you look at the Man United team, they do have a lot of talent up front. Maybe not quite the sort of dependable source of goals that Lukaku was meant to be. But what really needs improving is that defence. So you could say the Maguire deal is more important than getting a Lukaku replacement to sell them.
Yeah, and keeping Pogba
even if
well.
They are two very important areas that need improving.
And just really finally on this sort of transfer look, I noticed today Pochettino's got, there's a hashtag back Poch, I think, because basically he's got a bit upset that, well, basically he's not being backed, and then the fans are calling for him to be backed financially. So I know you had some views on that, Sam, and you thought it was a bit, he's kind of changed his tact a little bit on his job title.
Yeah, so he's throwing his toys out the pram a bit and saying that he's not involved in transfers when he's very much involved in transfers. But I just found it interesting that he made the claim about changing his job title when him and the club made a big thing about him changing his job title to manager back in 2016. So it seems like it's come full circle. It seems to be a continuous cycle with Pochettino and Levy during the transfer window, that he wants to try and sort of call his bluff and do battle with him a bit just to try and get that yeah. extra signing over the line.
But this was the summer in which that was all meant to change. And Levy's comments, a recent, I think it was a kit deal unveiling recently. It was some kind of commercial sort of announcement. And he was giving a presentation in which he did talk up a strategy shift in terms of funneling more investment into the team as opposed to sort of the stadium, which they're paying off still, of course, but they've had to kind of, you know, rein in the spending during this period. And it's not even necessarily a case that it's the bringing in of players that has irked Pochettino, because they issued a statement saying Danny Rose is not included in pre-season because he can to negotiate with other clubs. He's been unable to find another club. Now he's joined up, I think, with their pre-season. And he's a player who kind of, after speaking out, Pochettino seemed to have made a decision to sort of phase him out a little bit, and then was brought back in and was impactful and is still their best, most dependable left back. But I think I get the impression that Pochettino wants to kind of, you know, just get rid of the uncertainty surrounding Danny Rose, who's been public about maybe seeking another challenge elsewhere. So Pochettino obviously wants a player more committed that he can build a future team. Well, not build a future team around, but build a future team with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a few.
And so that's got to be part of the frustration. And obviously they were linked to Dybala not 2 days ago, and that would have created a huge amount of excitement among Spurs fans, because that is a marquee signing, really.
Yeah,
for
absolutely.
Them.
Which they're not used to, are they, to be honest, in the last few years.
And then not even a week later, he's now in talks to join Manchester United. Mm. So I have sympathy with him, because this was meant to be the summer where you build on the Champions League final appearance.
They signed Ndombele really early, didn't they?
Yeah, he thought that would start something, didn't
he? That's the start. They were linked with Lo Celso, loads of players, but they just haven't come to fruition. And like you say, Will, I think quite a lot of it does hinge on clearing out some of those more fringe players.
Well, there's certainly the players that have had uncertain futures, so obviously it's a big week or so, the transfer window closing and then the Premier League season starting, so we'll just about wrap it up there for today's Squawker Talker. Thanks very much to Will, as always.
Thank you for being back.
No, it's a pleasure
stepping into the breach.
I'll say when Norwich are pushing the Champions League places, I'll be back, I'm sure. Sam as well, thanks mate.
Cheers mate,
and we'll speak to you guys next time. Thank you.